Welcome to the Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:11 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is May 20th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So, I thought this was a really interesting graphic from Berliner Morgenpost. So, it's showing heat centers are all the way around the globe. Now, of course, there are limitations in how any data is reported or indeed gathered, because if you look at the map, you can see that in the middle of Africa, there's no readings at all. And since that's right in the middle of the equator, one would have to think that you'd have to that there's at least some heat readings there. So there's a concentration of readings from the most populated areas, and I guess that makes sense. But we can definitely see that there are spiky areas, particularly around India. So, and if we just look at the top of the world, then those are really big spikes all the way around India. It seems to be much hotter than other places. And of course, we don't have a lot of data coming out of China either. But it's sort of reporting that most of the heat will probably be along the coast. So, I think that's rather interesting. But one thing that we can certainly see is Egypt, for example, has got this massive heat spike. And then also, of course, we have Brazil. And then we can look at Mexico City. So it's not only that we have heat spikes going on around the world, but that they're concentrated in some of the largest cities. And certainly that's also true along the west coast of the USA. So, and then of course we've got Tokyo. Well, these are obviously problematic because there are millions of people living in these cities, and it's going to become progressively more energy intense to try and keep them cool. So the emerging markets are obviously at a disadvantage here because they have to go off and build all that infrastructure. And of course, all that infrastructure runs on electricity. And historically, the electricity has come from coal. So if they're going to get control of the heat problems, well, they're going to have to do something to generate a lot more electricity. Now, we can think about water stress. And I'm trying to figure out now how to. Let's see, we can exit that. So, this is the. I'm just going to scroll down. We've definitely got heat, and the unfortunately, it's not loading as fast as I would like. But water stress is also concentrated in large parts of the world, and it's problematic in large areas, and water is exceptionally expensive to ensure that it's clean and get it to the right place at the right time for the right people, and everybody needs it, so it's a completely essential product. It's often been a difficult thing to invest in because we don't really have an easy way to increase prices. Nobody likes paying for water, and it's a very price-sensitive market. So then infrastructure tends to get built, and the companies building it have difficulty raising money from it, or in fact, even getting paid. Now, there's also this ongoing fear about rising sea levels. So when we think about the long term, and how do we hedge ourselves against this increasingly upset world? Well, obviously, rising sea levels are one of the things that a lot of people really worry about. And it's a time in history where there's a lot of things to worry about. Some of them we worry too much about, and probably some things we don't worry enough about. But rising sea levels are something that have been threatened for years, haven't yet turned up. Of course, a negative can't prove a positive. So that doesn't mean it's not going to happen in the future, but it really hasn't been much of a factor yet. One thing that is certainly a factor is that cities have more people in them. Cities have more concrete in them. And a number of cities around the world are sinking simply by weight. And that's certainly a factor in places like Miami and a number of other cities around the world as well. Venice has been sinking for years. So these are obviously other, I think, factors that we probably don't worry enough about. And then, of course, there's the whole threat of major glaciers peeling off into the South Atlantic or the South Pacific and inundating many of the world's cities. But that's not an urgent risk. And then, of course, we have wars. So there's certainly plenty of things that people are worrying about. And one thing that we can definitely think about in terms of all of these things that people worry about, whether it's rising sea levels or water stresses, or whether we're talking about heat or parts of the world that could be uninhabitable, then they also tend to concentrate on the same areas. So that's, I think, a rather interesting fact that when we look at India, it has some incredible opportunities and then also really quite profound challenges. But the stock market continues to exhibit relative strength, and it was up in a pretty dynamic manner in here today and holding the region of the low put in at the end of March. India has a phenomenally large young population, and I thought it was especially interesting to see that we're definitely seeing more manufacturing heading that way. And this was I posted charts yesterday to exhibit that. There were two things that I thought were especially interesting. The first is that we're certainly seeing manufacturing moving out of China. So I think that's a rather, I think, a long-term profound change. If we had to think about one thing that has been more important than anything else, it's been the resilience of China's economy and therefore also their dominance of various manufacturing sectors. Well, textile exports from China peaked in 2010 and have pretty much been going sideways since, but they are trending higher in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. So we might just say Greater India has taken on a rather significant proportion of the global textile sector. And I thought that was rather interesting. But then when we compare the cost of employees in China, well, it overtook Mexico in 2014. And that's another important characteristic. So the world was willing to deal with China and not really pay a great deal of attention to the willingness of the Chinese administration to ignore the conditions of the WTO, and was it was very protectionist. And then there was this whole intellectual property theft and the necessity to share intellectual property with anyone who wanted to sell within the country, and the rest of the world was happy to go along with that for at least 15 years. And then around 2014, China's cost of manufacturing and cost of labor started to trend, or to really start to pick up again. And it suddenly wasn't the cheapest place to do business any longer. And then we can think about it was in 2016 that President Trump was elected, and there was the populist revolution, and there was a lot of questions asked about the wisdom of the whole globalization theme. So, is this correlation or was it causation? Was it that China has suddenly become more expensive and therefore the risk of upsetting China was materially less? because there was less foreign direct investment flowing into China. And when we think then about the FDI flowing into China, well, this is the FDI net inflows as a percentage of GDP. And it's last updated in 2020, but we can see that as a percentage of GDP, it has been trending downwards, but most particularly trending downwards from about 2010 onwards. So when manufacturing peaked in China, it was in about 2010, and foreign direct investment has really not been keeping up with the growth in the size of the economy over that time frame. But then we have the additional point that we're starting to see more questions about exactly what the merits of being invested in China from a longer term perspective are. Because credit expansion in China has been really ramping higher since about 2010. So prior to that time, the vast majority of growth was organic. And since about 2010, the growth has been fueled by credit growth. So we have the opposite condition in the USA, where total credit in the economy actually contracted following the credit crisis. I think that's a rather significant factor. And I think it's important to pay attention to this because there is a divergence going on. Now, whether it is driven by climate, whether it's driven by geopolitical factors, or the peaking out of low-cost manufacturing in China and their necessity to move up the value chain, these types of themes are coalescing at present. Now, I think it's also interesting to frame the discussion about the wisdom of Russia invading Ukraine in those terms. Now, the Russian ruble isn't being updated relative to the dollar on Bloomberg any longer, but it is being updated versus the euro. Now, if we put it the other way around and we look at this on a really long-term trend, we can see that the ruble has now broken a 20-year downtrend versus the euro. So this is a material move. And the thing that I find especially interesting right now is that the media is full of this talk of the impending debt default in Russia because the dollar window is going to be closed to them, so they won't be able to make dollar payments on their debt. But Russia has one of the lowest debt to GDP ratios in the world. It's less than 20%, and the currency is breaking out. And if we look at the, and this is a dollar denominated index, but the RTS index has rebounded pretty impressively from the low around 600. But perhaps more importantly than that, it didn't break down to new lows. So it's already recouped about half of the big decline heading into the invasion. Now, I'm not in any way apologize or being an apologist for authoritarian regimes. I still think that Russia is a very dangerous place to invest, and it's not like it's going to be easy to get one's money out. But is not a slam dunk to think that Russia is suddenly going to experience a depression as a result of its decision to invade Ukraine. It has voluminous commodities, resources. Nothing has happened to damage Russia's wheat harvest. They have oil, and it's trading at a discount everywhere else. They have fertilizers. And then they also have a relatively peaceful domestic situation. And countries around the world are absolutely desperate for their exports. So it's primarily the OECD or NATO that are not importing Russian goods. But Europe doesn't have a choice. They have to import Russian gas. And Germany, in particular, is heavily dependent on Russian gas, and then even more dependent on Russian oil, because there are several European refineries, particularly in Eastern Europe, that are linked up to Urals oil supply via pipeline. And if those refineries stop importing oil from Russia, well, then a big swathe of Eastern Europe isn't going to have any gasoline or diesel or any other product coming from those refineries. And Europe relies on Russia for 70% of its diesel. So when we look at these charts, we've had a significant rebound in Russia. And we've had a really quite significant pullback in both the Nasdaq, but then also in Germany. And the DAX is right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I think there's the real possibility that what we're going to see in Europe is a return to a status quo, and that the war in Ukraine is increasingly being isolated in the eastern portion of the country. When you have a U2 performing in the subway in Kiev, you'd have to conclude that the war is happening somewhere else. So I think that seems to be quite clear. It suggests that we're moving into more of a new normal type of situation where Western Europe will import as less as it can from Russia, but everywhere else will just go on and pick up the slack. Places like India are going to buy Russian products, and they have a very independent foreign policy. And more to the point, they have a huge population and they need to feed them. And climate conditions in India have been rather challenging with these extraordinary heat waves. Now, this is the worst heat wave they've had in India for nearly a century. And it's exactly the time of the year you'd expect a heat wave, so that at least is not that surprising. But temperatures have been rising, and not least because the population has increased, urbanization has increased, and cities and concrete structures become heat wells. So that represents a significant challenge for India. It means that they're going to have to invest in new electricity supply. There was a lot of questioning about the coffee price in and where it's going to go. I think one thing that we can see is that sugar is certainly trending higher, and it has clearly rebounded from the region of the 200-day moving average, and it remains in a really quite consistent medium-term uptrend. We had the initial spike higher in Arabica coffee because of the threat, or it was the reality of a drought, not excuse me, a frost in São Paulo. And that was about a year ago. And now there's a threat of frost again this year. So frosts are really not good news for coffee. Now the price shot up earlier on this week and it came back down in here today. But the challenge here is that a lot of people are looking at the threat for of the global supply chain for foods, and there have been some significant issues that are worrying people. So the first, of course, is that inflation is contributing to higher commodity prices, and the continued strength of oil is a central factor in that. So, oil prices continue to hold here above the $100 area and remain really quite steady. So, the oil price is Right at the upper side of this range. We've had a sequence of higher reaction lows since March. There's been a sequence of lower rally highs until earlier this week, and that has now been broken. And oil continues to firm here, so there's certainly the potential that oil prices are going to pop on the upside. The big challenge for oil is a lack of investment. When we think about what countries are doing, OPEC likes high prices. They're not rushing to increase supply in a big way. Companies are terrified of investing in new oil properties because they're worried about what it's going to mean for their social media profiles. Are they going to be trolled? Are they going to be accused of raping the world? BP is going to invest $36 billion in Australian hydrogen. Now, I think that there's a long-term argument for why hydrogen is a viable solution, but the one thing it isn't is oil. If they're spending $36 billion on hydrogen, it's $36 billion they're not spending on oil. I was playing tennis last week with an oil and gas banker. They're raising a fresh fund to invest in prospecting, essentially, and they don't anticipate getting any investments from institutions. Whereas previously, it was pension funds and endowments were buying up half of the funds. Now they're not buying any at all. So there's a lack of investment, and this is dragging on the ability of the sector to increase supply. So the national champions continue to do well as a result. And Petrobras continues to steady here at the upper side of its base formation, and it continues to have this world-beating dividend. And despite the big dividends that are going to get paid next week, then it's still going to yield 19% once those special dividends have been paid. So what this also suggests is that the oil companies are giving back capital, but they're not investing in new supply. And the oil services sector remains depressed. Now, I think it's a recovery candidate, but we're not in anything like the kind of environment that we had before the peak in 2014. If we look at one of these longer term charts, so for example, Petrofac in the UK, really graphically helps illustrate the difference in the kind of bull market that we have right now. Back in 2005 through 2012 and 13, we had supply inelasticity and rising demand. So we had the advent of China into the World Trade Organization, and that created a big demand shock. And there was a lot of investment in new supply because there was almost guaranteed new demand. So there was a drive to get more volume into the market. Today, we have a supply shock. So we have artificial supply inelasticity. And we have continuing demand. It's not like demand has suddenly shot up for oil, but it's simply that we have supply inelasticity. There's nobody willing to make the investments in new supply. So this is not great for the oil services companies. They depend on that new investment. What it also suggests is that when they start to break out, it will be the beginning of a new investment cycle, for the oil sector. But we're just not there yet. So that's, I think, a rather important factor. I think that the oil services sector will inevitably rise because the higher oil prices go, the greater the incentive there will be to invest in new supply. And eventually prices will rise enough that they will overcome some of the reservations. So it's not a question of if, but rather when the oil services sector, in fact, breaks on the upside. But of course, if oil prices pop on the upside, it is going to drag the price of every other commodity up with it because of the cost of production. So we've definitely seen some easing in the wheat price, and the backwardation has now changed from being a supply challenge, or the backwardation has completely reversed in wheat. So there was a very wide backwardation. Now we have a contango. So this would suggest that prices have gone up enough that we're even starting to see some supply or some demand destruction occurring in the wheat price. But corn prices remain firm because it's an ingredient, or ethanol is an ingredient in gasoline. The higher the gasoline price goes, then it's going to put upward pressure on corn as well. But corn prices are very overbought in the short term. So I do think that there is potential here that some of these agricultural prices are going to be susceptible to some additional downside, and not least because we're starting to see backwardations coming through. So the Invesco DB Agriculture Fund is a futures fund, and it underperformed in spectacular fashion between 2012 and 2020. And it needs a backwardation, and it needs very strong uptrends if it's going to continue higher. If we're going to start to see more contangos coming through in the commodity sector, this fund will fail to continue to outperform. So that's certainly a note of caution, because it is a futures fund rather than simply buying equities. And then we've seen that the veggie ETF, the Agricultural Producers Fund, has already pulled back, and it's in the region of the 200-day moving average. And some of the bigger constituents in that, like Mosaic and Nutrien, are also unwinding their short-term overbought conditions relative to the 200-day moving average. What we are starting to see, though, is some additional interest in seeds. So seed producers seem to be doing better here. Corteva is one of those, and then Bayer has, or at least it appears to be, coming to the end of the Roundup litigation and bouncing from the region of both the 200-day and 1,000-day moving averages. So when we think about the longer term, there are certainly challenges. There are climatic challenges, and there are challenges arising from the war in Ukraine and the upward pressure it's putting on commodity prices. But then, of course, we have issues with how central banks are dealing with these challenges. And it's, I think, integral to what's happening in the markets right now. When we go to the chart seminar and we think about what are the two big factors in markets, the first one is price action, because the crowd is a mob, and the price action and the chart patterns tell us what's happening with the mob. And then we have money flows. And it's just a truism that it's easier to make money in a bull market. And you have bull markets, or bull markets thrive on abundant liquidity. So if we look at the size of central bank balance sheets, they've done nothing but increase for a decade. And the size has been coming down over the course of the last 6 months. $2 trillion has been lopped off the value of global central bank balance sheets. Now, it has begun to steady, but this has been a really significant event, and that is really before quantitative tightening begins. quantitative tightening is not going to begin until the beginning of June. Every time the size of central bank balance sheets has contracted, it has contributed to outsized volatility in the stock market. So the last time we saw that was 2018. The market pulled back by 10% in February, March. Then it pulled back by 20% between Thanksgiving and New Year. And they convened the plunge protection team. The big banks went in and started buying shares. They stopped raising interest rates at the same time. They started cutting 6 months later, and the size of the balance sheet stopped contracting and rose very mildly at the beginning of 2019. But of course, it exploded higher in 2020. And we're now experiencing the hangover from that especially large injection of liquidity. Then we have the quantity of money that is spent that governments don't really have. So deficit spending took a leg higher during the pandemic. And this isn't a new phenomenon, but it is an exaggeration of the previous trend, because we've seen this deficit spending become a progressively more important factor in how markets function. Global deficits are still running at $1.2 trillion, but a year ago, they were running at $2.4 trillion. So we've had a meaningful reduction in deficit spending. Now, we're still way above where the values were prior to the pandemic. So this is still an historically large deficit. It's just that it's not nearly as large as it was a year ago. But these are two major liquidity drivers. The size of central bank balance sheets is one, and that's contracted by $2 trillion. And global deficits have contracted by about $1 trillion. So that's $3 trillion has been taken out of circulation. Then I created another chart in here today. And I looked at the interest rates of the G20. And I thought, well, we can look at the number of countries that are raising interest rates. And the global interest rate could also be a total. So we just add all the total interest rates together. And because what we're seeing right now is a huge degree of commonality. It's not simply that one country is raising rates. Every country is raising rates. Two big exceptions are Japan and China. But the one thing that I should mention is that Russia, Argentina, and Turkey are not in this measure, even though they're part of the G20, because the data on Bloomberg for their interest rates only goes back to either 2013 or 2008. And I wanted to get as much back history as I could. But what this clearly demonstrates to me is that there's huge commonality in interest rate hikes around the world. And lots of countries have been very aggressive in raising rates. So Brazil has raised rates by nearly 1,000 basis points. Just this year, Egypt has raised rates by 300 basis points. That's not in this chart even, because they're not part of the G20. So we're definitely seeing a lot more interest in these in this sector, that interest rates are rising, people are worried about inflation. Central banks feel like they need to do something. So this is what they're doing. They're raising rates. The size of central bank balance sheets are moderating, and we're also starting to see deficit spending starting to be curtailed. Now, there is nobody running on a balanced budget program. And that is as true in Europe as it is in the USA. And then we think about the election in Australia. Australia is really only just coming out of its lockdowns. They still have plenty of room to jump back into economic activity. But One thing that I find especially interesting is that stronger our currencies like the Australian dollar haven't been surging, but at least it's starting to find support. It would be normal to anticipate that commodity-related currencies should do better. The big question, and I think I really do believe that it's a very big question, is what do we expect countries to do about their debt? Because we've seen a lot of worry about inflation. But the inflation is in large part a byproduct of the quantity of money that was printed in 2020. And as we've seen from the last three charts, it's starting to be withdrawn. And the bigger threat right now is that growth is going to moderate. So if growth's going to moderate, then that's good for bonds. And we had a big downward dynamic in the 10-year yield last week. And we had downside follow-through in here this week. And the 10-year yield is back below 2.8%. So it has now clearly broken the midpoint danger line stop. This is no longer a consistent trend on the upside. We have evidence of resistance in the region of 3%. So this suggests that the peak is in for yields and that growth issues are going to be much more important than inflation issues from the perspective of bond investors. Now, it's an awfully big question whether oil prices can continue to rally if global growth slows down. That's an additional reason why the big oil producers aren't willing to make those kinds of investments. But oil, at the moment at least, continues to push on the upside. I think we're going to see in this cycle whether it is realistic but that the USA is going to experience Japanization. Because we've seen with Japan that they went through a massive boom in the 1980s, and then they went through a huge bust, and they haven't successfully been able to reignite inflation or to raise interest rates for decades. And then Europe went through a boom and a bust, and hasn't really been able to raise rates yet. And in this cycle, they're still in negative territory for their deposit rates. They're only just beginning to talk about raising rates. So the USA has raised rates by 75 basis points. And Fed futures are pricing in a terminal value of about 3% for the Fed funds rate. But the 10-year yield is there already, and now it's starting to come back down. I think there is clear potential that it is going to unwind its oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. And that would suggest that there's about 100 point, 1% or 100 basis points of fat on the price. It could come all the way back down to 2%. We could have a significant growth scare. So, that would certainly help with the inflationary pressures. And we would then see central banks relenting, and we could start to see the stock market recovering. The challenge right now is that it's really tempting to look at the number of indices and instruments that are in the region of their respective 1,000-day moving averages. And we can look back out over the last decade and say very clearly that they have bounced every time they've come back to the 1,000-day moving average. So this is an exceptionally attractive buying opportunity. And I have a lot of sympathy with that, except for the fact that we don't have any liquidity. And bull markets need liquidity to put in a low. You need to have available cash. You need to have the belief that monetary conditions aren't going to tighten further. The big challenge at present is that the PE, the forward PE ratio for the S&P 500 is back at its historical norm. But that's assuming earnings don't fall. And earnings were massively flattered by the big bull market off the low in 2020, when we print several trillion and pour that into global markets, it's going to inflate earnings and asset prices, and we've seen a lot of that. Then we can think about lumber prices, and lumber is pulling back. So this is clearly some evidence of less demand for timber, and that the rising cost of real estate is cutting into demand. So there's really the potential here that it might come back down and test the $400 level. Now, I don't think that it's going to come all the way back down and break back down into the base formation. I just think that we are more in a difficult, less predictable environment, and we would need to see a really profound change in growth. The one thing that I think is also worth highlighting is that if interest rates do start to come back down and bond yields start to moderate, well, then mortgages will also become less expensive. So that's a support for the housing market. As we think about where can we safely put money? Well, we're in a more uncertain environment geopolitically and certainly if we're in the natural world. We're in a more uncertain environment in a monetary and a fiscal sense. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think it's yet the point where new money needs to be put into the market. And I'm certainly not doing that. I reduced some of my investment positions and I'm still net short. And I think that we're going to have more of a surprise on the downside. I had thought earlier on this year that we would have a surprise on the downside and that would scare the Federal Reserve. I also thought that inflation might have already peaked, but inflation has yet to significantly peak, and therefore it's going to require a bigger shock to the system. When we think about and what I've been talking about is the chicken and egg scenario. The last thing the Federal Reserve wants is for the stock market to recover. Now, the S&P 500 was well off the low in here today. But the challenge is that if the market does rebound, and it is arguably due a rebound because we have a short-term oversold condition, well, then that's going to inflate asset prices, and it's going to further enhance the potential that the Fed will have to raise rates. And high yield spreads have continued to rise. Now, it did steady over the last couple of days, but the trend is still clear. And the high yield spread is up to 500 basis points. So it may not have broken through that level in here today, but it is back at levels that have proven to be problematic in the past. If it reverses from here, and we see clear evidence that high yield spreads are coming back down, well, then that would be certainly a mitigating factor. But there's nothing to say that we're not still yet in a corrective phase overall. And if we are not going to move into an aggressive new monetary printing cycle, then the Fangman shares aren't likely to perform nearly as well. So when we think about the relative performance of those 8 large companies relative to the total market, well, they've been underperforming very clearly now, and the ratio is coming back down into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. If this breaks lower, then we're witnessing a clear change of leadership within the market. So, even in a recovery scenario, it would be more advisable to bet on other sectors rather than to leap back into companies like Apple, Amazon. Now, we're definitely seeing a lot of interest or a lot of commentary around Google. The share continues to decline, and not least because most of its revenue comes from advertising. And the advertising market is becoming progressively more competitive because every company now wants to generate advertising revenue. They used to have it all to themselves, then they had to share it with Facebook. Now they're sharing it with Amazon, they're sharing it with Apple. And then you have all the conventional advertising companies too. So this is becoming a much more competitive market. But DeepMind has released a new general AI, and they still say that there's a lot of work to go. But the innovation that they're claiming is that this is an algorithm that can learn by itself. So the one thing about computers is you only have to teach them once. And once they've learned something, they can compound upon it. So that's the argument for artificial intelligence. And it's potentially one of the bigger innovations, and it could certainly help with productivity growth. And ultimately, it will feed through into profitability for Google. But it's rather questionable whether they're going to build an AI or a general AI just to boost advertising revenue. A general AI, however, could quite easily be something that could learn to drive. So it does enhance the potential that Google will be the first company to come through with an autonomous vehicle. These, of course, are massive technological innovations, which could be inherently deflationary. So, if we start to see these kinds of innovations actually reaching fruition, well, then that would certainly contribute to the argument we're moving into more of a Japanization of the US economy, and that interest rates will not continue higher, and that automation in the economy will be enhanced beyond recognition. So these are, I think, rather significant issues, and it suggests that there will be a room for technology, and there will be room for hedges against climate change and agriculture, and certainly there's going to have to be a lot of infrastructure development because automation means more electricity use, and more electricity use means more generating capacity. So that is going to be beneficial for things like copper and the other industrial resources. Copper prices, having pulled back, have rebounded, but I still remain leery of the sector just simply because we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It would be quite normal to see a period of ranging between 400 and 450 and a decline later. Having had an inverted yield curve at the between the 10-year and the 2-year, I would anticipate that we are moving towards more of a recessionary environment. It might be required to change the minds of central bankers that they need to be more accommodative than tightening up. So these are, I think, some of the more important factors that were being proposed or were being presented with. Certainly, when we look at the size of the pullbacks that we've seen, and the strength of the dollar has been a really significant factor, and it does appear to now be changing. So a lot of the commodity-related currencies have pulled back and have been weak, and now we're starting to see the dollar peaking. We're starting to see yields coming back down, and this is on the back of growth fears. So stocks rebounded somewhat in here today, but growth fears and earnings are certainly something that should weigh on stocks. The bigger question is, when will central banks relent from raising rates and tightening liquidity? When that happens, we'll see a broad-based stock market recovery. But I do think we're moving into more uncertain environments. We're going to see shorter, sharper cycles. And ultimately, bond yields will trend higher. But we've had such a profound move that it's more likely that bond yields are now going to first compress. And they're exceptionally oversold. So that would probably be one of the more obvious trends that's evolving. The dollar is exceptionally overbought, so it has lots of room to weaken from here. So this is potentially beneficial for gold. And gold prices are finishing out the week near $1,850. We've seen a clear upward dynamic this week from the $1,800 area. So there is clear scope here that gold being hard money and being a barometer of the willingness of central banks to devalue their currencies, then it should do well in an environment where there is no government has any real plan for how they're going to pay back their enormous debts. And if bond yields do come back down, well, then government spending is going to increase. So eventually we will start to see yields doing are going higher because inflation will probably also come in waves. The global supply chain is changing. The global commodity supply chain is volatile, and we're seeing a lot of unsettled and sporadic changes in consumer behavior as people come out of the pandemic and feel like they need to live their best lives, and they're impatient for better living conditions. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.